Welcome to Only in Clark County, the show with the mission to share the stories of the people and places that make Clark County unique. I'm your host, Brandon Heinbigner, and I found it all too easy to get caught up in our day-to-day lives and forget to get out and connect with our community. The purpose of this show is to encourage us all to do just that. Engage with the special people, local businesses, and local attractions that can only be found right here in Clark County, Washington. Hello, everybody. Today, please help me welcome our guest, Brad Richardson. Brad is the executive director of the Clark County Historical Museum, and he is here to tell us more about the museum. Brad, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a bit more about the mission of the Clark County History Museum and what it offers to Clark County?
Yeah, so in short, the Clark County Historical Museum is here to gather, save, and share the pieces and the stories of Clark County history. And we do that through a number of different ways. We do it through four galleries inside that we have where we have exhibits. We do it through walking tours that we do to explore what we call the museum of our community. And we also do it through a variety of talks and different ways that we engage with the community. And then there's some other behind-the-scenes stuff that we do also around the community that, you know, not a lot of folks know about, but it's a part of our work in preservation.
Where are you located in Clark County?
So we are located in Vancouver's historic Carnegie Library. We don't say old, we say historic. And it's at 1511 Main Street, and it's in downtown Vancouver. And usually what we use is kind of the marker for people is if you've ever been to the Brick House, we're one block north of that on the other side of the road. It's a building that was built out of hidden brick. It was originally built in 1909, and it was originally on land that was owned by the Hidden family. And if anyone around Vancouver, Clark County has ever heard of the Hidden House, that wasn't some kind of like speakeasy or like secret location. It was actually named after the family that started a brick manufacturing company here in Vancouver, and it was Lowell M. Hidden that originally owned the land where the museum stands today. And it was a clay pit, and across the street from there, they actually had their brickyard where they manufactured, you know, bricks and all of that. And eventually they, you know, took the clay out of the earth where the museum is at today, manufactured bricks, and then brought them back to construct the original portion of the Vancouver Public Library, which is the building that we're in now. And then additional sections were put on in the 40s. So, yeah, it's definitely, it has a little Ridgefield brick in there, too. I have to give props to Ridgefield also.
Okay. Can you tell us when the museum first opened?
So the museum itself first opened in 1964 because it was in 63 that the library moved out and into the new library, which is now the old library. There's there's generations now that have been
right
there. And so it opened in 64, and when it opened, it was a state-of-the-art museum with all kinds of modern exhibits, and it was opened by, at the time, what was the Fort Vancouver Historical Society. You know, the Vancouver Public Library obviously started in 1909. It operated in that building till 1963, and what happened over the 40s and 50s is that the library's operations expanded immensely, and I don't know if many people know this, but the Fort Vancouver Regional Library District. So if you're familiar with kind of the network of libraries that we have here in Clark County and all the way through Southwest Washington, that actually started in the museum. So imagine, you know, again, the museum is it's a good size museum, you know, it's a good size building,
right.
But imagine running an entire library district from a building that's, you know, a little bit smaller and maybe doesn't have facilities that were built originally. And I could probably say the same thing about it. The museum right now in turn. But what happened is that Eva Santee, who was the librarian who helped start this, she was a head librarian and really had the vision. She was finally able to get some bonds from the public pass to get the 1963 Fort Vancouver Regional Library building constructed. And so as soon as that happened, all of these people in the community kind of worked coordinately to say, well, now this is a great opportunity for us to be able to finally establish a museum. I think a gentleman by the name of Roy Jones and Dr. John Brower, who was one of the founders of the Vancouver Clinic, they were able to really get this started and make the momentum. Because you'll see Dr. Brower kind of up at all the speeches at the opening of the museum. And for the first a couple decades of its operation, he was really instrumental and kind of the figure for the organization. And so, you know, that effort to try and continuously have these museum, this museum established, or have a museum established, was important. The opportunity was there. And then the other piece that we have to really think about is, I mean, a lot of counties have museums. I mean, we think it's kind of a while ago because it's obviously over 50 years. It's now going to be 60 years. But 1964 is kind of late to the game. You know, I mean, you probably have some county museums that might have been established even, you know, earlier than that. And I haven't, you know, looked to see, but you got to think about it. This is a single repository for an entire very populous county to be able to collect its history. It's almost wild to think it wouldn't have one.
A big thank you to our founding partners at Morrell Inc. Print and Marketing for their ongoing support of community radio. Morrell Inc. is a woman-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop that since 1993 has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative printing and marketing solutions. Morrell Inc.'s experienced staff creates partnerships with their clients and uses the latest technologies to meet their needs. More information about which of Morrell Inc.'s products, printing, and marketing strategies will best serve your next project and budget can be found at morrellinc.com. That's morrellinc.com.
Brad, can you tell us a bit more about how you got in this field?
So I have kind of a meandering story on how I got to the field, and I guess I'm gonna go back a little bit because I'm a bit of a unique situation in this specific job that I'm in is for the fact that I was born and raised here in Clark County. You don't traditionally end up in a paid management position in the same county where you know, you grew up. And it's, you know, these jobs are few and far between. And so people will tend to move or kind of travel around to take these positions.
Right.
But I grew up in the Camas-Washougal area. I graduated from Camas High School. And then eventually, you know, once I got out of high school, I had to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And I had no clue what I wanted to do. So, you know, I came from a working class family, no college savings or anything of that nature. And my parents worked really hard, but, you know, they just didn't have anything for me to do that. So I had to figure out a way to pay for college. And so kind of had to look at student loans possibly. And then one day I was at a buddy's house and I was just listening to the radio and, you know, which we're on right now.
Sure.
And an advertisement came through for UPS needing workers. And they talked about their earn and learn program where they would pay for college.
Hmm.
And I was like, well, that sounds great. And so, you know, I was working at Fred Meyer's at the time on Choklov and decided, you know, okay, I'm going to get out of the grocery business and start chucking some, hauling some cube. So anyways, I applied and, you know, it's so funny when I went in there, you know, I'm like 18, 19 years old. I'm all nervous. I don't know if they're going to hire me. I don't know if I'm qualified to move a box and get in there. And obviously they hired whoever would be a warm body.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up getting a job at UPS and I was a loader and I you know, applied for the earn and learn program, which I am immensely grateful. And I always, whenever I get the chance to mention that, I have to, because I'm very grateful to UPS for that. And so that same time I, you know, enrolled in my first quarter at Clark and started my long journey with my associate's degree. I'll tell you, that whole getting your college paid for is a great thing to a point. When you know that, you know, you kind of have infinite money and as long as you don't graduate, it doesn't matter. you kind of do a little bit of wondering. So instead of, you know, backpacking Europe, I took every single class possible at Clark. So I spent 5 years.
Backpack Clark.
Backpack Clark, basically. So I spent 5 years getting my associate's degree. I have enough credits to actually get 2 associate's degrees. When I finished, and I took a bunch of language classes, I ended up going on an exchange trip to Germany. And during that time, I went, eventually became management very quickly at UPS, a part-time supervisor. And that's where I got a lot of management experience. I ended up working in HR. I ended up working in safety. I ended up working in retention. I just continued to bounce from department to department. I ran some load lines, which is, you know, how the packages get loaded. I ran some sort lines over there. And I promise you, I'm getting to a point. and so I learned a lot of management skills and really good management skills. And I had to manage under probably some of the most intense pressure you could think of, because like seconds matter when you're managing a load line at UPS, because you've got boxes just flowing. And I did this at 19, from 19 until I was about 23, 24. And eventually I decided, you know, I met my future wife, and I decided, well, it's probably time to finish that degree. And so within like 2 quarters, I just finished. and then I was like, you know, I don't know if UPS, I don't know if I want to bleed brown and want to, you know, haul cube for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And so I went and did some odd jobs for a while, tried to kind of explore some different opportunities, and then eventually landed back in a corporate setting, in a corporate office for a telecommunications company, North Sky Communications, and worked in human resources and payroll until I was almost 30 years old. And at that time, my wife was going to nursing school, and I worked two jobs. I worked, well, three actually. I worked at North Sky. I worked on the weekends at Best Buy, because I was working there for a period of time too before that, and I kept that job on the weekends.
Okay.
And then I was chopping wood for a guy and doing odd jobs just to make ends meet, because I didn't want her to have to work while she was going through school. So eventually she graduated with her nursing degree, and she got a great job nursing at a local hospital. She works at Legacy Salmon Creek.
Okay.
And she looked at me and said, "Hey, you need to love your life." And I love, you know, North Sky was a really nice place, but, you know, running payroll and getting yelled at when someone's benefits were messed up wasn't my my idea of a dream.
Yeah, jeez.
So I ended up going back to WCU Vancouver to get a bachelor's degree. And, you know, I'd always loved history. I figured I'd become a history teacher, although I still had a conception that history was names and dates and kind of like just repeating, you know, regurgitating information. And as soon as I got into my first history class, I sat down and they started talking about the method that historians go through to find information, and how you have to compare sources and the debates over, you know, this person's interpretation versus that person's interpretation, and how you have to take multiple pieces of evidence and try to triangulate, you know, an idea of what this story is trying to tell us, and then how do you communicate that value to the community. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, like this is like critical thinking, like critical thinking training. And that was when I first keyed into history is not a dominance of content. It's a dominance of practice. It's just like any other skill, you know, it's like a surgeon, you know, the surgeon is good at the practice of surgery. He doesn't know about all the surgeries,
right?
You know? And that's how most of the modes of our society work. It's someone is functionally good at the practice of their job. And history is kind of funky in how we see it, because we think of someone like having a bunch of knowledge of content and that's like their value. But you can actually be very skilled at the functional work of how to gather information, take that information, look at it to create a understanding of it, and then communicate that effectively to the community. And once I saw that in the degree, I was like, this is amazing. And I was like really excited. You know, I was going to go become a high school history teacher and really try to communicate the discipline as opposed to the content, and really make kids grapple with the thought and theory of history. And then in one of my first classes, a professor announced that there was a opening at the Clark County Historical Museum, which I had never visited. and for volunteering for, you know, some event, and I volunteered for, it was Harvest Fun Day, out at the Heritage Farm. And then after that, I said, "Hey, I want to come in and intern," because I was one of those, you know, later in life, adult returning students. Uh-huh. So I understood, like, I can't just get a degree. I need to join a club, and I need to do an internship. Like, there's all these things I need to do. And I went in and I interned, you know, just entering information into a basic spreadsheet was one of my first things. It was like, one of the most boring, tedious tasks. And then the director at the time was kind of a, if you're a warm body, we'll throw you into something. And she just randomly asked me if I wanted to do walking tours. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I'm terrified of speaking in front of people, and I'm totally nervous I'm going to get something wrong, but now's the time to try something. And so I started doing those, and eventually that evolved into doing a lot of program work. And then from there, she gave me an opportunity to help co-curate exhibits and then eventually curate a full exhibit. And after that first year of working for free every Friday and Saturday, she said, hey, you want a job? Because they had one of the staff that was there, was working job share with her, or she needed someone to work job share with her because she couldn't work over certain hours. And so they hired me on for part of her hours while I was still going to school. And from there, I went from a visitor services coordinator assistant to visitor services coordinator to museum experience coordinator to curator and now director.
Wow, that's interesting. How long ago was it when you very first started working weekends there?
My first volunteer gig was in 2010, and then I started as an intern in 2011. So in total next year, I think it'll be 13 years involved with the museum, with 12 years working, with 11 years of paid employment. You know, it's just like anything in the nonprofit world, and especially anything in the humanities world, is you have to have, one, a very supportive spouse, because the hours can be quite brutal. I mean, I worked Saturdays for 5-6 years, and she was so awesome to accept that. And then, you know, you're not breaking the bank with what you're doing necessarily. So having that partner that's willing to share the lift for the family on that is really important. And then the other thing is you just have to have a grit and determination to just continue to put one foot in front of the other, because the work is fun and there is a lot of great stuff and it's amazing to be able to tell the community stories, but it is quite a hike to be able to walk up that hill and continue to make things happen, especially in the director position. Because, you know, I sometimes think back to those wonderful days where I just had to read some books and write some history. And now today, my opportunity and my privilege is to be able to be the person to try to communicate why people should invest in this and why it's valuable to our society to have a strong center for memory.
Have you always wanted to buy a washing machine and support affordable housing at the same time? Well, now you can at the Clark County Habitat for Humanity store. They have furniture, appliances, building materials, rugs, paint, flooring, tile, and tons of other new and gently used items. Every purchase supports home building projects right here in Clark County. You can donate your own things too, or better yet, you can call 360-213-1313. That's 360-213-1313, and they'll come pick them up from your home. The Clark County Habitat for Humanity store is located on Southeast 2nd Street near the corner of Mill Plain and I-205. They have everything and the kitchen sink.
Can you tell us what some future goals you have for the museum are? Where would you like, say, in 5 years, what would you like to see it be doing?
It's a really important question. And, you know, our museum, where it's at today, is so different than it was 5 years ago. And it's so different than it was 15 years ago. And it's monumentally different than it was, you know, almost the 60 years ago when it started. And as a good historian, I like to look back kind of at our story to think about, you know, what our future looks like. And, you know, we started as a place where we had people who really were ingrained throughout our community, who were part of, you know, some very recognizable organizations. They were leaders of the community, and they saw the value of they saw the value of saving this story and sharing it with the community. And I think over time, we've kind of drifted a little bit away from those leaders, and I feel like in the last 5 years with the transition of kind of the board that I came in with, which were all really community-centered folks, that we're bringing in more leaders from a broader sense of our community, from, you know, broader aspect. And we're starting to see those individuals that are kind of at the forefront of thinking, you know, where is our community going, being a part of our organization. And then in addition to that, looking historically back at our organization is just plainly seeing, you know, who really was involved, whose story had been communicated, whose story had been saved, whose story had been shared, and really taking a thoughtful look and a deep examination on where the gaps were present and have been present and are present for us, and reaching out meaningfully and repeating one word again, being present, mm-hmm. with communities that maybe don't feel like that we're their museum. My real focus is to, without ask or qualification, to try to have both our board and myself and our staff and whoever we can and volunteers present with communities that we want to earnestly demonstrate that we are and can be their museum, but do it on their own terms, provide them agency, be facilitators, be enablers of them to be able to tell their story their own way and be unextractive in doing that. And that's a lot of long, hard work. And so my hope on that aspect of kind of looking at the past of who we've had involved is to keep our community leaders engaged with our museum while also getting out of the way for those who need an opportunity or who should have the opportunity to have a place where they feel their story has a home. So mixing those two things from the past is really important for me. And then through that work, through creating that stakeholder relationship, through creating agency, through facilitating, seeing our exhibits be more, kind of community conversations as they're developed, being, like almost like a coming together of the minds to have conversations over what these would look like, and making these gathering and engagement opportunities, as opposed to like I said, coming down the mountain with two tablets of history as historians, and really decentering ourselves as a staff from the decisions of kind of how the story's told, but instead we're the people who are facilitating that work through the tools that we have to do that, and giving the community and the people the center for that storytelling. And that is an insane, crazy, wild goal, mm-hmm. to some degree. Not because there's anything wrong with that, but because it's just not how museums have operated. And the thing is we're all committed to that, regardless of how lofty that may seem, because I mean, you obviously know you bring lots of people in, there's gonna be lots of conversations, and it takes more time, but we want to be able to do that and make that happen. And then to be able to see more people in the community understand that we're their center for history, we're their center for storytelling, we're their center for thoughtful conversation on who we have been and who we want to be. And then seeing that community come and be present in our conversations or talks in the community, present on our walking tours and sharing their stories as we're walking through the community, and just continuing to have generative conversations through our programs and engagement that goes two ways, so that it's not feeling like people are being talked at, but they're being discussed with.
Are you a musician or artist in the local Vancouver, Portland area?
Ready to take things to the next level?
Well, New Waves Northwest on KXRW has got you covered. Send in your song submissions to submitmusic@kxrw.fm for a chance to be highlighted on one of our upcoming episodes.
New Waves Northwest is the best place to discover bands and artists from the Pacific Northwest and all over the country. Once again, send submissions to submitmusic@kxrw.fm. And as always, stay wavy.
For any listeners out there who want to support the museum, how can they go about doing so?
So I would say there's three ways that they can help support us, which is through their time, their talent, or their investment. And I don't say treasure because we're not pirates. but, you know, it is, and I'll get to that in a second, but it is important to say investment. So their time is really coming to one of our programs, coming to a walking tour, attending a speaker series event, attending a History on Tap, because if we keep doing programs, if we do programs and we're just doing those programs for two or three people, eventually we have to kind of, you know, say, all right, well, I guess we're not going to do these anymore. And so those conversations, those engagements, those moments of being able to hear the memories of the community or talk about the stories or, you know, grapple with those are going to go away if we don't have people give their time to come to those events. And I know time is precious and, you know, there's lots of great things on Hulu this season. But, you know, just take a time, maybe four times a year, to come out to one of our speaker series or one of our History on Taps, attend a walk, you know, break up the monotony of your life by coming out and getting some culture, and understand that when you're doing that, you are feeding those stories and empowering those stories, because one, you're going to hear and listen those and then pass those along to people in the community yourself. But also you're going to promote our ability to continue to do these programs, these talks, these walks, these tours. So, you know, given some time to do that, and then your talent, you know, we have lots of need for help, you know, from people at the front desk to doing research, you know, to all kinds of, you know, walking tour guides, all the things that we do. Four of us can't do all of it. And so we need many, many talented people. And then investment is, you know, becoming a member of the museum, you know, providing an end of year donation, getting other people to become members, tell your friends what a valuable resource this is. And the reason I say investment as opposed to like treasure or donation or whatever, donation sounds kind of like a dead end, right?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I donated and I'm done and I'm never coming back, right? And, you know, treasure, obviously, you know, it has its own connotations. But investment means that I am pouring something into something that I find valuable, that I plan to remain connected with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's important, is because, you know, we want you to stay up, either whether it's through social media or coming to a talk or coming into the museum or volunteering. We want you to stay in a relationship with us and understand the evolution of what you're putting into us, how that will grow. Because over the last 5 years, not a single dollar that's come into this museum hasn't grown multiple fold for the community. We've made everything just blossom through the additional investment that the community has made in us. And we can continue to do more of that and even better versions of that if people continue to invest, if people continue to tell others to invest, and they continue to grow what we can do. And, you know, you can connect with us via our website. So it's, you know, cchmuseum.org. And, you know, that's where you can sign up to become a member. You can donate there. You can check out, you know, the exhibits that we have. Our events calendar is all through there. We're also on social media. So you can check us out on Facebook, again, CCH Museum, Twitter, and Instagram. If you put in CCH Museum, you pretty much find us on most of those resources.
That sounds awesome. Brad, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is great.
And thank you, everybody, for listening out there. We hope to see you next time on Only in Clark County.